The opinions expressed on this show are solely those of Jeremy Hinks and Sticky Jazz Podcast and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else on this planet.
Okay, everybody, welcome to Sticky Jazz. I'm Jeremy Hinks, the man of a million musical opinions, all of which happen to be correct. This week is part two of the Danny Saber saga. You want to know the rock and roll story? This is where we get really deep into just rock and roll and places he's been. And he tells, this is the U2 David Bowie segment of the show. But he's also talking about his time with Marilyn Manson and Flea and everybody else. So let's fire this one off. This one is coming out of the Million Dollar Hotel soundtrack that Danny Saber did the work with the, I had to pick this because it's, you know, Lou Reed, the Satellite of Love remix from the Million Dollar Hotel film soundtrack. So let's all sit back and do the Sticky Jazz.
Thank you.
I'm gonna say, like, you have quite the resume. Again, I have to say, one of the funniest entries on your resume, though, is it says, because you've got Bowie, The Clash, everywhere, and then all of a sudden, there you are on Ozzy's Blizzard of Oz playing Tubular Bells.
Oh yeah, I just was joking about that earlier.
I was like, you play Tubular Bells too while you're at it. Let's hear it.
No, but again, did you ever see Liberty Valance? Print the myth, print the what is it? The myth. What's this famous thing? The you print the truth or the myth? Yeah, look,
You would have been rather young at
I would
that
have
point,
been
right?
13 years old, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was a prodigy tubular bell player. Now, what actually happened is good funny. And I now look, you got to look at it from the position I'm in.
Okay.
I had just mixed two Black Sabbath songs. In fact, here. Thought I had an open one. They finally just came out on vinyl.
Okay.
First two songs Ozzy did with Sabbath in like 25 years, and it was the reunion tour, right? So I did the mixes and some additional production, and I had put, it was like I've never felt more like I was doing the devil's work. I mean, it was awesome. So I did a string arrangement, and I added some. I actually had a sample of Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells, which were the actual from The Exorcist, right? So those were going on. I think I might have dropped some Alistair. Like, it was amazing, right? Cut to, I get a call. Hi, Donnie, it's Sharon. We're re-recording some of the parts on the Ozzy Blizzard of Oz in the and the first album, Diary of a Madman, right? And I was wondering, we need to redo some of the keyboard parts, And I'm like, I'm there. Like, fucking dude. Okay, so now, you want to talk about being a fan? Hold on, hold
Oh, my
on.
brother is gonna die when he hears this, 'cause
Wait,
oh,
hold on.
he's okay.
Hold on, stop. Hold on. What's
Oh
that?
boy. Okay, Osborne
Dude,
World Tour, right?
and I became really good friends to this day with Rudy Sarzo. I got to meet Rudy. Dude, I was at. This is from the Diary of a Madman tour. Look at that, Tommy Aldridge, bro. Rudy fucking Sarzo. So when I got offered to play anything on a record with Randy Rhoads, dude, I was like, I cannot take money for this. Like, this is like, it was like a religious thing. So, and what had happened was the Masters had bounced back. There was some sort of dispute, because it's all Lee Kerslake and Bob, and I didn't know about any of that. All I knew was, oh yeah, man, I can get to, they were sending me
You had
parts.
the masters. That's all you knew. Yeah,
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 I got
yeah.
the masters. I can solo Randy solos on Revelation, Mother Earth, and I think Diary. I think those were the two songs I redid the stuff on. But it's hilarious when you look at the credits because it looks like I played on them in like what, 1981 or something.
Right. Cool. That I'm well, you okay, your all music entry has that year on it. Has that as
Yeah,
the year
that's
for
what's
it.
kind of
So,
cool. And
yeah.
technically, like, I'm not one of those guys. Like, I know guys who, like, if they fart on a record, are you gonna get a disc, man? Do I get a disc? Do I get a disc? But if I wanted to, I could have a wall, maybe someday when I make enough money to buy them myself, because you can buy them if you can show you got to legitimately have played on them and stuff, but you can order them. But I mean, just that, those are two I want. And I should have got them from Sharon. I don't know why I never got a couple. Like, I didn't even get paid to do it. Like, they could have given me a couple. Maybe I'll ask Michael, her guy, because they're good people. And I got to sit down with Sharon and Ozzy before the Osbournes, dude.
Okay.
The first thing I had to do was go have a meeting with the two of them. And it was fantastic because I had never seen the Osbournes yet. It was probably 2 years before that, maybe. So they were exactly the same. Like, there's no acting on that show. That's who they are, man. And I love Sharon. I mean, she gets, look, again, it's all perspective from where you're sitting. Always fair with me. She's always treated me right. But there's other musicians that may take umbrance with that. But it all boils down to this. That lady, as a businesswoman, was a trailblazer, man. You know, she pulled Ozzy out of the depths and built an empire and you want to talk about a man's world, you know what I'm saying? And you know, she deserves, and the way she's been treated recently by, I think, is not cool at all. And she deserves a little better. Because, you know, just as a person having an impact on the industry, as a business person, you know, she's no joke, man. So anyways, that's your answer. What else you got?
No, I just saw that. I kind of laughed. I was like, tubular bells. I thought, I mean,
Well,
so
they
you're
were sample. I mean,
multi-instrumentalist, but you're getting credit for tubular
yeah,
bells.
well, I
That's
did
whole,
play
that's
them on
awesome.
keyboard, you know, so I did play them. I wasn't sitting there.
So,
That's the mistake, man. Print the myth, right? Liberty
print
down.
the myth. So I was just so
Honestly, that's the problem with the world now, is everybody knows everything. But you know, all the mystique, it's because this is, but I'm happy to reveal now. It's like been long enough, right? I always think that though. You know, it's funny you say, because I would always think, I bet somebody's gonna see this and think like, this guy must be 90 years old. Like, or he played on the record when he was 12. God, he looks good for 80.
And let's see. So, like you're like all over the place on Along Came a Spider with Alice Cooper. You
Well,
had
yeah,
quite a.
me and Alice basically, I mean, that's a crazy ass story, but like that was sort of the last big budget record. Like it was sort of the tail end. And I did it with this guy, Greg Hampton, and Greg had sort of orchestrated a deal. He had a guy in Germany who was he was tight with, and he kind of was able to put this deal together right at the right time. He got to Shep, and in the meantime, there was a record to make. And you know, we pretty much wrote, I'm actually really proud of that record, dude, because we wrote at least six or seven of the songs on the spot. Like, and that again was that fun thing of like Alice would come in and you know, we would just start kicking ideas. It's like, hey, okay, well, what are we gonna rip off today? I don't know, let's listen to school. You know, I never had to listen to anything. It's all ingrained. And he was cool like that, you know, but he had a concept for that record. And then luckily, you know, we finally, because it was kind of weird and I never really got to meet the band. And I'm like, don't you have a band, dude? And he's like, yeah. And then they kind of, and I mean, I'll be honest, the two best songs on the record came from Chup, you know, the bass player, and Killed by Love. And, you know, Along Came a Spider is a pretty good one. Greg wrote, really was his song. Some of the songs were mine, some of the songs were his. You know, and it was that kind of a deal. But we just said, fuck it, let's just split everything because I'm not going to sit here and start keeping track of who did what. But, you know, the band made a huge contribution sort of in the, you know, 11th hour. And they were great guys when I finally got to meet them. You know, it was just kind of a weird dynamic initially. But, you know, I'm glad I got to do that. You know, like it was pretty, that's what got me into golf, actually.
Oh, was hanging
Because
with
I, yeah,
Alice
well, I
Cooper,
had
yeah.
never played golf up until that point. And Alice's whole thing was like, okay, you produced the Rolling Stones, so you know you're qualified, and you got the Golf Channel. And he was in the 300 club. Like he plays 300 rounds of golf a year. So every day he would play golf and show up around 12, 12:30. He was up at, you know, and he kept telling me about it. And if you're not a golfer, you know, you're like listening to all this stuff, and it's like, but you don't get it until you really start playing and get into it, you know. And it's not something you can do casually.
Yeah, so have you played have you played Jeremy Ranch here in Utah?
No, I've never been up there. But one of my best friends runs a bunch of golf courses in Nevada, in Vegas, and he was up somewhere, and I have to go find it in Utah, and he was up there playing the golf courses. And he told me, and this guy's played everywhere. He's played that. What's the one course where they had the match where the drones bring you shit? You can't even apply to be a member. It's harder to get into than Augusta in Vegas, that really famous golf course. They just had the match. He said these courses were off the chains, and he's played everywhere. So I know there's amazing golf courses in
Well,
Utah.
they have a big one here, and they played at Jeremy Ranch. Jeremy Ranch is one of those big, exclusive, nice courses that they have, you know. So I know that like when
Do you play
Rush,
golf?
I can hit a ball. That's
Is
but
it aerially
when
good? Well, you're aiming. You have a pretty good sense of when you try to hit it, where that it's going to go kind of in the general direction you're
yeah,
aiming.
that's about it.
Yeah,
Yeah, I.
that's an accomplishment, you know.
But When Rush comes to play Utah, when Rush when they would tour, they played Jeremy Ranch every time they came through town. They would make sure they were doing it at a good time of the year so you could go and play 18 holes. You know, so yeah, you got to check out Jeremy Ranch. If you ever come up to Salt Lake, man, I'll take you out there. We'll go. That'll be it's
Shadow Creek. Shadow Creek is the one in Vegas I'm talking about.
okay.
You heard of Shadow Creek?
I've driven
Remember
past
they had
it.
Tiger versus Phil? And they have drones that, like, you know how they have people in carts that will bring you drinks and stuff on the golf course?
They have
They have.
drones, yeah.
And dude, that you can't like apply to even be a member there. Like you have to be invited. It's like Augusta level, like the Masters level. Forget it.
And there
And
you
he's
are with your
played
own
it. And
homemade
he was
driving
right. Well, no,
range.
I've never been there. But my friend Steve has played there, and he told me he's like he runs golf courses now. And he called me from Utah, and he's like, dude, I'm in Utah. You wouldn't believe it, man. He's a brother. He's like, and there's a lot of nice white people.
He was at Jeremy Ranch then. That's where he
I'm
was.
sure he was. Yeah. Well, maybe we'll get to play golf someday. That would be fun, man.
I'd love it, man. Let's see. So you did some of the programming on All That You Can't Leave Behind. I mean, you've done plenty with U2. You're up there with you're in an exclusive club with Francois Kevorkian, Brian Eno. You know, like they did some really good experimental producers for a while,
Yeah.
and then when you got in on that, I was like, I remember, yeah, you were on that
I'll
Happiness Is a
do a little
Warm
bit.
Gun,
I
man.
was always the bridesmaid and never the bride. And like part of it was just like, look, when they were on the Pop Mart tour, and I didn't realize this at the time, I had done a remix for them because of Butch, because they asked Butch brought me in and we did a remix together. We kind of put this thing called the Sonic Morticians. It was me and Butch Vig and John X, my engineer. And you know, it was awesome. So I got to kind of go in the studio with Butch Vig, and he was the brains of the operation, and kind of he guided and told me what to do, which was really amazing. And then, you know, they reached out. I can't remember if a few things happened, and they reached out to me, and I ended up going up to, it was like the kind of tail end of the Pop Mart tour, and it was amazing. I flew to Vancouver. Went down like to the gig, spent the night in Vancouver with them, got hung out after the show, like with in their home. It was just and it was weird because like I'd spent a bunch of time on the road with the Stones, and they take two floors of the hotel, and there's a party in everyone's room, and you too. It was literally the band, me, and T-Bone Burnett in a room, and they're going through the show after the gig, like talking about what went well, what went wrong, like no crazy, no groupies, no none of that shit with them. They were very like. And then I ended up staying in Edge's house in Malibu when that was later a $1 million hotel. So and then we flew down to Seattle. I got to fly on their plane. And it was funny because every time, like hey, listen, Danny, whatever you do, don't bring anything on the plane. I'm like, dude, what do you mean? I just flew in from America. Like, I don't have anything. And they kept saying, and then literally seven different people that worked with the band. Hey, you don't got anything, right? I'm like, no, man, I don't. What am I? What do you think? Right? Finally, I come to find out, you know, Howie B, the DJ, he had been opening the show as a DJ.
He
He
would
got caught with
open
like a
before the
pound
bands,
of
yeah.
weed, like the week before, like if or not days before, and got. So, anyways, then we flew from Vancouver in, but on their own plane. It's like, you know, and there's like, you know, it's like a 727 that's been converted. And then, and I wished it was like, it sucked because we flew from Vancouver to Seattle, which took I wish I could have flown from like to Australia on that plane, dude. It was the most amazing plane ride ever. And then Edge is like, what are you doing? And I'm like, nothing, I'm with you. And he's like, I ended up getting taken to Eddie Vedder's house in Seattle with the Edge. And hung out with Eddie Vedder, and it was like just this weird, crazy trip. And what I didn't really realize is, I guess they were kind of checking me out, maybe to produce the All You Can Leave Behind record. So I know I was a candidate to produce the record, but then they ended up going back with Lanois and Eno. And what ended up happening was, cut to a few years later, Bada was working on Million Dollar Hotel, and it was just kind of a chance thing because I'd known them pretty well by then. And I went, I there, you know, there was the Village in LA, a recording studio, like, you know, all the Steely Dan records, a famous studio. I knew they were in there. So I just left a note for Bono, and he called me like an hour later. He's like, "Kenny, I need you, mate. Get down here, right?" So I go down, and what it was they were trying to finish the All You Can Leave Behind record, had to be done by a certain date, right? And in the meantime, he had been working on the $1 Million Hotel, and there was a bunch of shit that needed to get done on that. And even though technically it wasn't a U2 record, they were helping with the record because Bono
Right.
had the script. It was like that was Bono's solo project,
Yeah, him
right?
and Vim
He would
Vendors,
never
yeah,
make a
they
record. It was a movie, and everyone was pitching in. And so I just got brought in to start doing all this different stuff. And what ended up happening is that kind of crossed over, and I went ended up flying to Dublin, and we were on this deadline, like where I had done a remix of Satellite of Love. And it was him and Mila Jovovich, but I had done a whole new version of it. And Bono loved it so much. I had to stop in New York because he wanted Mila to redo the vocal to the new version. Because I had taken the pre-existing vocals and like what I did with Michael. And he's like, maybe we should get her to sing it to the new shit because it's a different vibe, but whatever. So I stop in New York, do that, get on the plane the next day, straight to Dublin. And it was literally like I got to, and it was right around Christmas. It was right around, the millennium too. I think it was the 1999, 2000.
Yeah, I was gonna say because Million Dollar Hotel tied up right there at the end of the millennium. I remember because well, there was the documentary about the $1 Diaries, I think. Was that what the documentary about Million Dollar Hotel was
I
called?
don't know. I've never seen that, but like all I know is that, you know, I went down and met Wim Wenders and saw a screening of the film, and that was all in LA because they were up at the Teatro, which was Lanois' place. So that's where I got, you know, and I went up there and stayed up there with I stayed with him for a couple of days up there because Edge and Bono both had places up in Malibu. So it was pretty much a straight shot at PCH. And Dan had this place called the Teatro, famously. I think he did the Willie Nelson record there. And it was an old like Mexican softcore porn theater. Like it was B movies, like Mexican B movies, Spanish B movies from the 70s, plastered all over the place. And he had converted it because that was his thing, you know. He'd take a morgue in New Orleans or an old, you know, movie theater in Oxnard, and he created this like studio in, out of it. It was really cool, but it was like being in a theater. And that was really the first time I met Dan, and you know, it was cool, man. It was a cool experience, and I stayed with them. And long story short, I ended up in Dublin, and we literally like I flew in on a Friday, and it was like on Monday. No more $1 Million Hotel, back to All You Can Leave Behind. And this mix had to be done. And there was only two studios in Dublin at that time, like world class. There was Windmill Lane,
Windmill Lane,
and it was U2 Studio, which was basically their studio. And we were having a hard time finding a room because this was still on two-inch tapes, and it was basically a U2 master, you know. So I ended up having to rent every piece of rental gear in the country because can you imagine? I don't know who was in there, but somebody got a call at Windmill Lane. Some artist had it locked out. And it was, I think, a younger artist. And it was like, "Hey, listen, is there any way you could let Bono come in for the weekend? You're in Ireland and you're owing Bono, and Bono owes you a favor. And like, you tell him to fuck off." They told us no. So I don't know who was in there. So I had to go in this place called The Works, and it was just, you know, just this, it was a hole in the wall. It was like a, but somehow, man. And the funniest part of it is I had like literally, there was only a 1-2 inch like Otari. I had every piece of rental gear in the country and things were hanging from the ceiling. And Bono shows up, like, I'm like, B, this is on like Saturday night. I think I flew in on Friday. I had Saturday and Sunday to do the mix. And Monday we were done because the band had had enough of the $1 Million Hotel. So he walks in at like 5 o'clock on Saturday night, and I'm like, "Dude, just go home." I go, "Let I got to get a handle on. I haven't even been able to hear anything yet. Like, we got to get all this crap working, and come back tomorrow. Hopefully by tomorrow I'll have it pulled together, right?" So he comes back the next day, and he's literally got a sleeping bag. Like, we aren't leaving till the mix is done. If we have to stay there all friggin' night. But somehow, magically, since when he left, I left that night, everything kind of put it all up and doing mixes in those days on those on big consoles, there was sort of just like a mystical part of it. You just kind of, and sometimes they come together and sometimes they don't. And he walked in the next day and I had a standalone CD burner expecting to be there all night, literally. And I had thrown down a mix. I'm like, man, this is sounding pretty good. I'm going to throw one of these down because anything can happen. The computer can crash.
Oh,
Like,
yeah, back then, yeah,
throw a fucking mix
totally.
down. So I threw it down and I'm like, fucking, I'm going to drop one before he gets here because I know he's going to want to hear what I've done. And then whatever. So he comes in and he's like, how's it going, mate? And I go, well, I go, I want to play something. So I took him in the back room because I only had it on CD. And I put it on this little box. I go, let's check it out. He listens to it. He goes, let me listen to that again. And I played it to him twice. And he looked at me and he said, mate, he goes, some people in this world make your life very difficult. Some people make it easy. He goes, thanks for making my life easy. Let's go get to
Oh,
it.
wow.
And dude, he told me himself, he was notorious. He goes, don't think I just like, ran out of patience and gave up. He was so happy with the mix, dude. Like it was one of those things I kind of dumb lucked my way through it and it all fell together. And we ended up going to his pub. I ended up staying in his house and he had this amazing house. There's this stretch of like it's sort of beachfront property in Dublin. It's called like the Irish Riviera, and it's like the Australian embassy's there. And it literally looks like the French Riviera. And there's all these big mansions, and I went swimming, and it was like in January, it was February, December. It was right before New Year's Eve, and the pool was heated, and it was probably 25 degrees out. It was amazing. Naomi Campbell was cooking fucking pasta.
That's a story, man. Jeez, no,
Well, the
I'm
other cool thing I got to do is at some point I got dumped at the studio, and I was and they put me in the room with Eno. I spent a whole day alone with Eno.
Oh, wow.
And Eno's just like, hey, can I? And then I was throwing down shit and just trying stuff, like just being in a room with him. Like, it was enough. It's just a fucking Eno, dude.
Oh, I
It's
know. No, like
Lenoir
I the
is enough. Dan, I mean, Dan's no slouch, like Daniel Lenoir. It's like, dude, come on. It's fucking Daniel Lenoir.
Oh yeah, I know. Yeah,
But
the greatest
me and
Canadian.
Dan were
Yeah,
closer.
it's
I mean, Dan's older than me, and, I definitely looked up to him, but we had a nice, me and Dan really became good friends. But, and I felt at that point I was just getting to know him, but I still held him in high reverence and still do. But Eno, it's like, that's Eno, dude. That's Brian fucking Eno. It's like, that's the guy who tore up little pieces. Like, that's the guy in Berlin. Well, no, that was Visconti, but I think Eno was there too, right? Georgie. So,
Okay.
it's like,
When I met Brian Eno, just what you said on a U2 tour in Vegas, I yelled, "Brian fucking Eno." And he looked at me and said, "Oh, not been called it like that." He said something like, "They don't call me like that, but yes, that's, right?" He was just but you I said, "Brian fucking Eno." And he said, "Well, I don't yeah, something about being called like that." Do you remember Gavin, right? Gavin Friday. You've met
Well,
him.
funny enough, I was trying to search for it. Naomi Campbell, Gavin Friday. Who else was there? Adam was there.
Well, if Naomi was there, Adam,
I
yeah.
became like really friendly with Adam too. He was re Adam Clayton gave me a bass, dude. He's like this. And I'm like, really? It was this orange, crazy, sparkle fucking bass, like with a metal like a headstock. It was some custom bass somebody made. Gave him probably 20 of them, but he gave me a bass, dude. I took a bass back to LA with me, and he said, I'm like, wow, thank you, man. And he goes, well, that's for all the inspiration, like. Trust me, I ripped off more than one bass line from you. And I'm like, dude, stop. I'm like, shut up. Like, he's like, shut the fuck up, man. You're Adam Clayton. Like, every time I play an eighth note, dun, 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 it's him. He's in there somewhere. Like, you know what I mean? Every part was.
And he's telling you that he's
Yeah,
ripped
and then
off
he did
your
the
lick,
Blackberry
yeah.
record. A lot of people like the bass playing on that record. I think I might be the first guy to run a bass through a whammy pedal. I think I could take that credit for that.
So the other was I was at U2 in Denver, and I just met Howie, right? I just talking to Howie. I was in the VIP area, and I looked over and I saw Gavin Friday, and he was on these platform shoes. I didn't realize he's not very tall, right? But I remember I look at him and I just looked at him and I yelled, "Gavin fucking Friday."
Is that
And he looks at me and goes, just very cool, calm, because you've met him, so you could totally picture him doing this. He looked at me and said, "The same." you know.
Nice, there you go. Well, Brian, Eno's like a school, because I remember Bono telling me, because I was kind of nervous, and I didn't have a Mick Jagger in my house, but like meeting Eno, I remember like it was this whole thing, and I walked to the studio with Lanois because you know we were staying in that hotel they owned. I can't remember the name of it, the Claridge. And to get from the Claridge to U2 Studios, there's canals in Dublin, but
Yeah.
you walk through Trinity College. Which is a whole thing in itself. You know, it's fucking Trinity College, you know, all the great fucking poets and writers. And you walk them through Trinity College. And the whole time over there, you know, Dan's telling me about Eno a little bit because I know he's at the other end of this walk. And then Bono had told me too. He's like, what's Eno like? You know, he's a bit like a school teacher. You know, he's like, and he has this energy where it's not like, and Reeves Gabrels told me a lot about Eno too. You know, work he had a little different take on him, but bottom line is, he has that energy where he doesn't have to do anything but just be there, and you want to impress the guy. You want to do something, man. Like it's he doesn't have to do anything, and he's so reserved and just chill and like, you know, man, you know, he's very British, but. It was cool. Definitely not a letdown.
Talk about Bowie for a moment.
Okay.
So, because I look, all roads go back to Bowie in the
All
new
roads
way of
lead to
punk.
Bowie. Well, all roads really lead back to Mark Bolan, actually.
Well, yeah, Mark
I
Bolan,
didn't
Buddy
get along
Holly,
with
right?
Mark Bolan. So all roads lead back to Bowie. So I never knew that, by the way. I never knew. You know, Mark Bolan was a huge star before David Bowie. He had his own, anybody that really knows anything knows that. But I didn't always know that. Like, I definitely didn't know it as a kid. I think I discovered that like semi-recently, like in the last 10 years, let's say, with the internet. I mean, that's what's great about the internet. There's so much access to information now that you just didn't have access to. If you didn't stumble on it, you wouldn't know, you know? And now you can kind of look for things.
Well,
Not
like
everything.
I didn't know Andy Gill and you were involved with Michael. That really was like, whoa, because like I know Andy has done, you know, all the other work he's done.
Andy, I don't think Andy, I mean, talk about being like a bridesmaid, though, in a way. He produced the Peppers' first record, right? There was at least like two or three bands that like went on to be the biggest band in the world. I mean, the Peppers were the biggest band for a minute there. They had it,
Oh yeah. They had their
right?
moment,
They had their
yeah.
moment. Andy did their first record, you know, and that's when they were all still trying to figure it out. And it makes perfect sense, Andy producing that record because of the guitar thing and all that. But I know George worked with him too, though. But I think Andy worked with him even before George Clinton did.
Yeah, about Blood Sugar Sex Magik was when they started going a little bit over on the
That was
funky
real, though.
side,
That was
which.
way later. I mean, I'm talking like, I went to Fairfax High School for fucking summer school, bro. Like, trust me, I know the Peppers like before any, you know, when they were a local band. But I didn't know that Andy had done that at all. I found that out later. Like, here, let's look it up.
So
Andy.
I talked to Darren Henley about that just a few weeks before he died. Just that I loved the early Chili Pepper stuff when he was on it. You know, I mean, by the time they got to Blood Sugar Sex Magik, I was bored with them, you know.
Right. Well,
Yeah. But yeah, so
but you're
I'll.
that guy who like you're the guy who like here it is, the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Is this their debut record? Andy Gill. Yeah, 1984. I mean, Flea must have been, God, Flea must be older than, they must be older than me.
Oh, they're, yeah, they're. Well,
I ran
Flea,
into
he.
Flea, and I'll tell you what, you want to talk about a fucking dude? Like, I ran into him at an Erewhon, at like a health food market in Malibu. And I saw him sitting there. And I walked up and introduced myself. And he started getting pissed at me because I'm like, I know you may not know my name is Danny Saver. He goes, you're fucking Danny Saver. He's like, I know who the fuck you are. Like, right. And the thing is, the crazy thing about it was, did you ever see that movie, Less Than Zero?
Yes.
You know, all the club scenes in that film were shot at a club called Power Tools. That club
Okay.
was a real nightclub. It was run by a guy named Matt Dyke, who had a studio where they ended up, they did Paul's Boutique, Mario C, all the early Tone Loc, all the Delicious Vinyl. The first band I was in that I first told you about, Issa June, We recorded our first demos in that studio. That was like a step up from the place we had with an engineer, and Matt let us come in, and Matt, like some reason, liked me, let me kind of hang around a little bit. I took him to buy a sample. He's the first guy whoever I sat in a room with, and he said, "Okay, sample this record." And it was like Sgt. Pepper's Reprise. Then he's like, "Okay, now sample this record." And it was another song. And he goes, "Now play them together." Oh. And that there's a song on the Beastie Boys record where they sample them and do it. But like he was a DJ, but he had that mind. And he was like 20 years ahead of everybody. And he was the hipster, cool guy. And he was the guy who, like, I remember he goes, "I want to show you something." And he takes me into his bedroom in this, and he had this like, it was like above a business on Santa Monica Boulevard, this bitchin' huge loft apartment. And the studio was in the front. They did a lot of Paul's Boutique in that studio. This is Sgt. Pepper's of hip hop. Paul's
Yeah,
Boutique,
yeah, yeah.
one of the four or five greatest hip hop records ever made. He takes me in his bedroom, and it's like a mattress, right? A milk crate. Remember the old TVs that you could put a videotape into the TV, and it had the VCR built into the TV, like little.
No, yeah, the single
And
unit
then
out of
like
it, yeah.
five Basquiats all around the room, because he was super tight with Basquiat. That was
Oh my
it.
God.
He played me Wild Thing, the Tone Loc video, before I'd ever seen it. And that's like that song when it came out, that was like a cultural moment, you know?
Right,
Like,
yeah, because they were playing that in the new wave dance clubs
and they
where
were playing
there
it on
it was hip
MTV
hop, but
too. That's
it had
right.
the metal
And,
guitar, da 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 da. Yeah, I remember it.
you
Yeah.
know, that was that scene. And Flea, and we started talking, because Flea played on Bust a Move, and so it was all that. And we started talking about Matt Dyke, and they're the band. And if you watch Less Than Zero, they're the band in Less Than Zero.
Okay, I haven't
They're,
seen that movie in probably 20
yeah,
years,
there's a
but yeah.
band playing in a club. It's the Red Hot Chili Peppers playing in Power Tools. That shit
Okay.
actually happened. Like, I mean, they probably wouldn't have been playing there on a normal night, so they definitely shot the movie at that location, but it was probably a night the club was going on.
So with 85 was less than zero is 85, 86,
Something like
right?
that,
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
I mean, I was a kid, man. That was my first entree. And Flea was just so cool. He gave me his number, and I sent him a text, just like, I go, "Let's just take each other's number just for like, just in case, because we talked for like an hour. It was crazy. And I think I caught him at a good time. Something was going on, and he needed to blow off some, I don't know. Long story short, I go, "Take my number just so you have it. You never know." I didn't ask for his. And he fucking sent me a text. But by the time I got home, there was a text. And it was like, "Dude, really good talking to you. Definitely stay in touch." Which was just like, he's a dude, man. I could tell you some stories about him back in the day before he was a big rock star, helping people. He's done a lot of nice things for people. He's a good man, that guy, man. But let alone the music school he opened up. So let's go to David Bowie now. We got to flee from Andy Gill. It's your fucking fault.
Well, no, my Flea story is less than impressive. I met him standing in line
You told
at a restaurant.
it's
What?
fucking flee. You said it's fucking flee.
No, I met him standing in line at a restaurant in Dallas. You know where you have to wait out there holding those little flashy jobbies? And sometime back in the late 90s, I was like, oh, hey, Flea. Anyway, so give me a Bowie story, because let's see. I mean, you met Brian Eno, the whole. I mean, because like, okay. To me, the Holy Trinity of rock and roll is Lou, Bowie, and Iggy, right? And Brian Eno's in the middle of all that too. He's the spirit that keeps them all together, right?
He's like their spirit animal, whatever they
Yeah,
call it, right? Yeah.
yeah.
I can see that. I could buy that. Mine would be a little different, but Bowie is part of it for sure.
Bowie, Lou, and Iggy are like, they were all the
See,
best
like, I
friends.
could
They were all in each
never
other's
make
back
a definitive
pockets.
statement like that, because when you say that, I could like live the rest of my life by that. But then I could also say like Keith fucking like, I don't know. Like, if I have to start, like Mick Ronson, Keith, and
Oh, Mick Ronson, yeah,
Danny,
geez, yeah.
that's okay, even though they're not really connected at all. But like that, there was a window, there was a phase. Like, I've gone through so many musical phases. But I'll tell you one thing about Bowie that's pretty cool. So, like, I already told you, go back and listen to the Little Wonder remix. the slower one.
Okay.
Listen to the record. It was drum and bass, and it's Reeves, who became one of my best friends, doing all, you know, he plays with The Cure now, Reeves Cabrels, amazing guitar player. One of the most intelligent guitar players I've ever met, really smart, like Morello smart.
Yeah, I was going to say Morello smart, yeah.
Morello smart. And like super technical, but then at the same time, like when I got to do, I did a thing with Reeves where, well, I got to help Mick with a solo thing, and he said, we've got to find a guitar player. And I'm like, well, how about Reeves Cabrels? You know, he's like, hey, he does all that fidgety, noodly stuff. And I go, no, I go, trust me, Mick. I go, he played, his first gig was playing with fucking my man from Bad Company, the singer Paul Rodgers.
Paul Rodgers, yeah.
Twice. So I went to Reeves and I said, listen, I talked to Mick, because, you know, Reeves wanted to play on the shit bad. I go, there's one fucking rule though, Reeves. You're going to plug a guitar. You can have three pedals into an amp.
And that's it.
That's it. You get none of that, you know, because it was sort of, and he, because he was, Reeves is a fantastic guitar player. I mean, like, he can play anything. He's like a Berkeley, like, genius type dude, you know? So Reeves and then Garson. Why did I start telling you about Reeves? Oh, because we used to say it's like playing cowboys and Indians, right? Like when you're Alice Cooper and the stuff for us, because we're that generation, we are musicians because of them. So we can draw from everything. But if you listen to the remix, it's literally, I took the vocal and it was all that, you know, drum and bass. And I wasn't a big fan of that Airplane record, I'll be honest with you. For me, I'm old school Bowie. So I took it and I tried to turn it into fucking Space Oddity, dude. But the crazy thing is,
Heroes, man, Heroes. That's where you should have done it.
But whatever, dude. That's in there too. Trust me. The other remix is fucking Fame meets, you know, it's Carlos Alomar. And like, I just fucking channel whoever. Like, I'm a Carlos Alomar 1 minute. I'm fucking Robert Fripp the next. I'm Adrian Belew the next. Whoever it may be, right?
Uh-huh.
When you're working those, on that kind of shit.
Yeah.
But if you listen to it and there's an unplugged mix and I'm playing an acoustic guitar and I'm telling you the vocal, I could hear the whole thing done. Once I soloed the vocal and I kind of found a rail, I found this other key. It was all in there. It was all Bowie. It was all in the vocals. It was like, you didn't need any music, dude. It's wild. And you'll see, when you listen to it, you'll see what I'm talking about. They re-released that like very semi-recently, the Sabbath things, and it kind of sent my Spotify through the roof. At one point, I almost had 100,000 monthly listeners on Spotify, because when they released them, they were Danny Saber remixes, which was awesome. So it was like David Bowie, Danny Saber. It was kind of cool. But here's the cool bit. So here's the cool part of the story. So I get asked to do these two remixes. It's Bowie. I'm excited. And I'm like, it was like probably right at that point where I'd maybe reached my first peak as a remixer. Like, I really knew what the fuck I was doing. And I feel like I have ever since. And I took these, I did two of them. And I got told this story by Mike Garson and Reeves independently. I guess a bunch of remixes had been done for that song, because one of them ended up in the Hacker soundtrack. Yeah, Google it. One of them had, you know, I know you're looking for it. One of them had the Hacker soundtrack, and one of them ended up on the Saint, or I can't remember, but they were used in some movie soundtracks. And so they were trying to get remixes done. The David Bowie version of anything is valuable. And evidently they all sucked. Like they were like, so there was somehow all the band was together. I don't know if they were in the studio or where they were at rehearsal. And it's like, oh, the new remixes just came in. So everybody was like, oh, great. All right, cool. We're going to listen to the new remixes. Like, I can't wait. And they put on my shit, dude. And Reeves told me, and Garson independently, or the story twice, he said by the end of the first, second verse, everybody was laughing because it was so fucking like good. Like, they were so blown away. They were laughing at the
music. Like, we got it. We scored.
This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, but then here's the cool part. So then I end up getting a phone call. David wants to meet you. He's going to be in LA doing the Tonight Show with the band. So I got to go down to the Tonight Show, like Jay Leno at that point, hang out. We're all in the green room. I'm hanging out with David Bowie. David lights up a cigarette. I'm like, cool, we can smoke. So I'm start smoking, and this is still right when it was still kind of you could do it. But who's gonna tell David Bowie he can't smoke, right? Leno walks in. He's like, ah, everybody's smoking. Great. He pulls out this fucking cigar. He starts. So we're all in this green room with all the windows closed, like, and it was awesome. But and then I ended up getting to do a bunch more shit and really going in the studio with David. I helped. Another quick little funny tidbit. There's a song that Reeves did for a solo project. And he was in LA, calls me, dude, I need a studio tonight. David's gonna come down and drop a vocal. I want to record this song. Frank Black,
Oh, geez. Okay.
Dave Grohl on drums,
Oh, wow.
Mark Plante on bass, and David and Reeves. And you can Google the song. It's out there. It's fucking bitchin' song. And all I did was kind of book the studio and program the click. Like I didn't do anything. There was an engineer there. I just helped him organize it. I pulled in a favor. I got him Westlake because I could get studios like. And in those days, and I made a phone call, you know, but I was my ass was parked on that couch. So at one point, me and Dave Grohl, I don't know, Dave, and this is like, I don't think even the Foo Fighters was out yet, and if it was, maybe the first song had come out. So me and Dave are like sitting on the couch, right, and fucking David walks in. Now at this point, I've met him a few times. I've worked with him. I've met David, you know. I know Dave. Fucking David. Dave's like, dude. Dude, fuck, dude. Like freak, and I'm like, I know, it's fucking crazy, right? So they go in and drop the lay down the rhythm section thing or whatever. It might have been recorded, I can't remember, but they definitely recorded everything that night. And then David went in to do a vocal, and he was sitting there like, okay, he goes in, right? And me and Dave Grohl sat there, and we watched David Bowie put this vocal together. And dude, it was, listen, Google,
What was it? Tell me. I'm like, tell me what it was.
Google Reeves Gabrels, Frank Black, David Bowie, Dave Grohl song. It'll come up. I listened to it recently. I'm like, is that as good as I remember it was? And Frank Black's no fucking slouch. I mean, dude, Frank fucking, I mean, he went, and I didn't really, I'll be honest. Not that I wasn't a fan, I just didn't know. I mean, I know the obvious shit. I had no clue. I always loved Los Angeles. That's my favorite song of his. More than any Pixies song. Fucking Los Angeles is one of the best fucking songs. For me personally, because that's the way it switches from metal and, you know, and just the way his voice sounds and just how it's so like fucking floaty and then it's heavy. Do you find it?
No, I'm pulling up right now. Give me 2 seconds.
Right, let me see. I'll look too. It should come up. Bowie Reeves.
Here we go. It
What's it
is
called?
yeah, Jewel.
Try
It's
it. Play a
called
little.
Jewel. Yeah, I got it right here.
Let me hear the opening. Make sure it's the right song.
Reeves Gabriel's features Bowie, Grohl, and Black. The song's called
That's it.
Jewel. Yep, on the
Can you
key. Yeah.
listen to that shit, dude? It is the shit.
Okay, I'll have to give it
And
a dive,
imagine
man.
sitting in the room and watching David like just fucking just like anybody else. And he's like, okay, give me another track. And he did these fucking harmonies. It's and I love it's a cool ass song. In fact, I want to let a couple of younger artists hear. Somebody should cover that song because how many views does it have? Like 5,000 or something?
On the that one has 9,200 views.
Yeah. Fucking crazy, man. If you play it right now, can I hear it or no?
No, I wouldn't be able to pipe
Yeah,
it
that's fine.
through
You
here.
listen to it. You listen to it. I'll listen to it too.
Yeah, big honking collision track called Jewel. That looks great right there.
You'll thank me
Jeez.
for this, dude. And nobody
Oh,
knows
I
the song. It's dope. And it, so every time I see Dave Grohl, which is not a lot, but then like I ended up getting taken to a barbecue at his, he had just moved into some house. Twiggy took me because I was tight with the Manson guys. And Twiggy took me to this barbecue at Dave Grohl's house. And it was probably like 4 or 5 months after that session, maybe within a year. And I walk in and I'm like, oh yeah, I met him that night at the thing. He probably won't fucking remember me, whatever. And I get there and Twiggy's like, we're standing. Dave walks up. Hey, he's got like a fucking apron and a fucking he's barbecuing. He's like, I couldn't even get a word out. He had his girl. He goes, "This guy, that's the guy, that's the guy." Right? And I'm like, "What's up, man?" He goes, "Dude, the fucking Bowie thing, man. Oh my God." And I guess he got somehow, maybe he thought like I had put it all together or something. So I didn't say anything. I'm just like, "Yeah, I'm the guy, man. I'm the guy."
Man, I thought I had some rock and roll stories to tell, man. You
I mean,
got
we haven't even scratched the surface.
Oh man, God. Like yeah,
let's write a book, man. Let's write a script, bro. I got to. I'm hoping when I go through all these, I'm gonna get some traction with the right person because there's a way to put all this. And dude, the Michael thing. I mean, the story behind the story, all the shit. I mean, just the fact that I'm even in a position to do this right now is, you know, crazy, dude. When have you ever heard of an artist that sold 70 million records? Some guy and fucking releasing a shit. There's a story to tell, bro. And all the things that almost happened that didn't, that if they would have, I wouldn't be able to do. Like, it's so crazy. And it's almost like I, and I'm not like some hocus pocus weirdo motherfucker, but Michael's up there. He's pulling some fucking strings.
Oh, yeah. Michael, he's steering the universe to make it happen.
And he is, yeah, it's the power of the universe again and the vibrations.
He's steering the universe to make it happen.
Without a doubt. And he kept a lot of shit from happening for a long time, too. It's sometimes it's like, I will say it's like in music, you know what sometimes is the most effective fucking moment in a song? Silence.
So do you think he's at peace now that?
No, but he's almost, but now, and it's not hinging on whether he gets in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Like, don't think that's what it's about. That's
no, the way you talk about him, he's not that guy.
No,
it's
the energy you leave. This is what I've learned when people die. And then we'll cap it on this. Whenever anybody dies, it doesn't matter if it's an international rock star. You have friends that died, right? You know people that have died. What do they leave behind? They leave behind the memory in other people. That's the energy. It's how other people remember them or don't remember them. And most people, let's be honest, they die. Most people forget them. Unless it's like their close family or somebody, you know, very few people really, you know, carry on a legacy, let's call it. I'm talking about everybody that's ever born. Like, how many people does that happen for? Right. So in Michael's case, because of those circumstances and, you know, and look, I'm not saying it's good to die young, but like people are still talking about Hendrix. They're still talking about Kurt Cobain. But in Michael's case, it was a little different. And I think the dust had to settle. Enough time had to go by to really, for people to have the appetite, let's say, to really kind of just forget all that shit and just put the focus back on why he was in the position he was in the first place, because he was one of the first people to start to become more famous because of all the tabloid stuff. And it was in England, it was really bad. So you probably didn't know it, but he was becoming more famous for being famous, which now, you know, empires are built off that shit. But in those days, that was the worst thing that could happen to you. You became a joke, you know? And he was really like fearful of that. You know, that was like gnawing at him. So just to get recognized for his talent and how great he was and his band, you know, that, and again, it's not about any reward. It's just allowing that to happen and the dust to settle. And then, you know, and it's not even about him. It's about all of us, you know? Who knows where he is? But his energy and his spirits, definitely, I felt it. I've had people, I mean, dude, I've worked with a lot of bands, right? Which means I've met a lot of fans of a lot of bands. And every band has their own culture, right? Like the Stones have their own culture.
Right, U2 has their own culture, right, you know, yeah, yeah.
I have, and I'm not talking about INXS. I'm talking about Michael Hutchence. He inspired something in people, especially in women, that is very, I've never seen. Jim Morrison didn't have it. I mean, Morrison was an amazing, and I'm friendly with Robbie Krieger and whatever. The Doors are the Doors. I'm not knocking anybody, but I'm just saying there's
Michael
something.
Michael is different.
Michael is different, man. Like, you know, and I can't quite put my finger on it, especially with women. And I, you know, There's something there, dude. There's something there, and I don't know. Maybe that's a good way to cap it. You got anything else?
Actually, I wanted to say, what song do you want me to play us out with? I'm gonna open with, with the new one with Michael. But what do you want me to play us out with? I was thinking of playing out with "In the Name of the Father," unless you want me to pick another one that you've
Just
got
play
that's
one of
just a
mine.
jam.
Maybe play that Bowie remix because we've been talking about it. Play Little Wonder.
Okay, then all right, I will close this out with "Little Wonder." So, all right, everybody. So, this is Danny Saber, who is the producer to the Gods, but he's also played on so much, and playing us out with "Little Wonder," the Bowie tune that he remixed. And every thank you, Danny, so much. And I
Well, thank
wow.
you, Jeremy, and thanks to Sticky Jazz for having me on. I've really enjoyed it. It's been a blast talking to,
And
somebody who helps.
everybody else, take care, be good to each other, and let music do awesome in your lives. And thank you so much, Danny, for your time. Everybody, that was part two of the Danny Saber saga. Well, just as a rock and roll music junkie, that was just amazing for me to have that conversation with this guy. Special thanks to Barry Andrews of Shriekback for letting us use the theme and title of the song Sticky Jazz. And I'm going to play this one out. Here we are with "Little Wonder" that Danny did with the late and great David Bowie. One of the this is one of those episodes where I got to do the two of the Holy Trinity of rock and roll. Opened with a Lou Reed song and playing out with David Bowie's "Little Wonder." Thanks, everybody. We'll hear you, be there next week.
Shaking.